Welcome back to A Kiwi Perspective, the podcast where we dive deep into issues that matter to everyday New Zealanders. I'm your host, Graham, and today's episode is a critical look at a broken oath, why New Zealand's junior doctors are burning out and walking away. We journey into the hidden corridors of our healthcare system, not the ones you see on glossy brochures or government websites, but the real ones, fluorescent lit, emotionally charged, often understaffed. We step into the lives of junior doctors across Aotearoa, and we ask, why is a career meant to save lives slowly draining the life out of our own? Let's begin with a confession. For many of us average Kiwis, the health system is like the plumbing in the walls. We know it's there, we hope it works, but we rarely think about it until it bursts. And right now, the pipes are not just groaning, they're cracking under pressure. Emergency departments are overwhelmed, wait lists are growing, and amid all this, at the very front line are our junior doctors, fresh out of university, armed with knowledge and eager to help. Yet within months, many are already burning out. This isn't just a workplace issue. This is a national health crisis in slow motion. Part 1, the frontline fracture. Junior doctors, formerly called RMOs, resident medical officers, are essential to the functioning of New Zealand's hospitals. They're the ones you see at 3 a.m, bleary-eyed but focused, adjusting a patient's chart. They are the glue that holds the chaotic fabric of the public hospital system together. They rotate across disciplines every few months, from emergency medicine to general surgery to obstetrics. The idea is that they learn widely and deeply, that they're supported by senior doctors and a strong administrative system. That's the idea. The reality. Often they are the first to arrive and the last to leave. Sometimes they're the only ones on shift who can respond to urgent calls. One junior doctor described it as being asked to fly a plane with 2 weeks' training and a manual written in Latin. Earlier this year, TVNZ's documentary series Diary of a Junior Doctor brought this hidden world into public view. Viewers saw exhausted doctors breaking down in staff rooms. They saw patients dying while doctors scrambled to answer multiple alarms. They heard candid admissions of fear, guilt, and sheer emotional overload. One poignant moment came when a young doctor, barely 26, admitted through tears, "We're constantly on the edge. It's like drowning in slow motion." This isn't hyperbole. This is what researchers call moral injury, the trauma of being unable to provide the care you know your patients deserve. Not because of lack of skill, but because of systemic failure. Doctors have reported being unable to spend more than 5 minutes with a terminal patient. They recount stories of making life or death decisions on hour 14 of a double shift. Some have administered bad news without a senior present, without any emotional support, because there was simply no one else available. This isn't about a few bad days. It's about a culture that's come to accept exhaustion as normal, even noble. In anonymous forums and closed-door meetings, these stories repeat like a drumbeat. One junior doctor wrote, "Every time I clock in, I feel like I'm sacrificing a piece of myself to keep the system running, and I'm not sure how many pieces I have left." This isn't a call for sympathy. It's a call for accountability. Part 2, the numbers don't lie, but they do hurt. Let's strip it down to the stats. According to the New Zealand Medical Association in 2024, over 40% of junior doctors reported moderate to severe burnout. Not just tiredness, burnout, the kind that affects your ability to think clearly, regulate emotions, and carry out even basic tasks. Burnout that leads to mistakes, not because of incompetence, but because the human body simply is designed to function at redline indefinitely. One in three junior doctors said they were seriously considering leaving the country. Not just the hospital, not just the DHB, the country. And where are they going? Australia is the top destination for reasons that are as economic as they are cultural. Here's what the numbers tell us. Junior doctors in Australia can earn up to 35% more than their New Zealand counterparts. They work shorter shifts with more predictable hours. They have access to better mentoring and often experience less administrative chaos. And crucially, they are treated like professionals, not expendable labour. A 2023 internal survey by the Resident Doctors Association found that 68% of RMOs felt disrespected or undervalued by hospital administration. Only 22% felt they had access to regular, meaningful supervision. One Kiwi doctor now working in Sydney put it plainly, "Over there, I feel like a doctor. Here, I felt like a cog in a machine that didn't care whether I was broken or not. And that machine, it's losing more than people." In the last 5 years, there has been a 27% increase in first-year doctors who don't transition to their second year in New Zealand. Let that sink in. We are training qualified, competent, idealistic doctors, and they're opting out before they've even found their footing. Some leave after just a few months. Others wait for the first contract cycle. Many head straight to Australia before they've even paid off their first student loan installment. Speaking of which, medical school debt in New Zealand averages between $120,000 and $200,000. That's before interest, before rent, before insurance, before childcare. Many doctors don't start saving until their 30s, and some report needing financial help just to make ends meet during their first hospital rotations. One junior doctor we interviewed anonymously said, "I feel like I've traded my 20s for a career that's slowly eroding me. The irony is that we're meant to be healing people, but I barely have the energy to hold a conversation by the end of my shift." And here's the kicker. The stress isn't just emotional or financial, it's existential. Doctors are trained to take responsibility for outcomes for lives. When patients slip through the cracks, it's the junior doctor who lies awake at night, wondering what they missed. They carry that guilt, often silently, often alone. And all of this, the brain drain, the burnout, the bottomed out morale, is happening in the context of a global healthcare labour shortage. New Zealand isn't just failing to keep its junior doctors. It's competing in a market where the odds are already stacked against it. The OECD has warned that the global demand for healthcare workers will outstrip supply for at least the next two decades. Countries like Australia, Canada, and the UK are offering signing bonuses, relocation packages, even housing stipends. New Zealand, by contrast, offers unpaid overtime and vague promises of reform. So what happens? We become a training ground for export. We fund their degrees. We train them in our hospitals. We invest hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars. And then we watch them board flights to Brisbane, Melbourne, Vancouver, or London, never to return. Let that truth settle. Our current system is subsidizing the healthcare workforce of other nations. And the cost isn't just monetary. It's felt in longer emergency department waits, in surgeries postponed, in rural clinics that can't recruit a single permanent doctor. This is not a statistical anomaly. It's a policy failure, and it's costing us more than we can afford. Part 3, the price of staying. For every junior doctor who leaves, there's another who stays. Some stay out of a sense of loyalty. Some stay for 1 hour for partners, children, or aging parents. Others stay because they believe in public medicine. They believe in making a difference here, at home. But make no mistake, the price of staying is steep. The cost isn't just professional, it's profoundly personal. Take Dr. Emily, a second-year house officer based in Wellington. Last November, she applied to take 3 days off to attend her sister's wedding in Christchurch. Her leave was declined, not because it wasn't important, but because the roster was already short two staff. So she stayed. That weekend, she worked 2 14-hour shifts with just a few hours of sleep in between. She spent those hours administering morphine to palliative care patients, quietly adjusting their pillows, apologizing for delays. She watched her sister's wedding through a pixelated live stream during a brief toilet break. Later, she cried alone in the on-call room. "I was there for someone else's goodbye," she said, "but I missed my own family's beginning." Another story comes from a registrar in the South Island. His partner went into labour unexpectedly 2 weeks early. He was supposed to be on call that night. There was no backup and no senior doctor available to cover, so he stayed on shift. He missed the birth of his first child. These are not outliers. They are part of a growing archive of quiet sacrifices. Moments missed, relationships strained, health deteriorating. One 29-year-old doctor in Palmerston North described her life like this. "My entire week is work, eat, crash, repeat. I have zero time to reflect, exercise, cook, or even see my friends. My mental health is eroding, and I don't even know who to tell anymore." She was diagnosed with clinical depression and anxiety 2 months later. After a brief medical leave, she relocated to Queensland. Today, she works 4 days a week in a regional hospital with mentorship, counselling, and a full weekend to herself. She's also started painting again. This isn't resilience, it's systemic negligence. The culture in many New Zealand hospitals still glorifies exhaustion. Phrases like, "you've got to harden up," or "everyone goes through it," are still tossed around like rite of passage slogans. But the consequences are devastating. Relationships collapse. Young doctors report high rates of substance use, particularly alcohol and prescription stimulants, just to cope with the workload. Some quietly disengage, emotionally switching off to survive another day. Others leave medicine entirely. The Resident Doctors Association recently warned that attrition isn't just about numbers anymore. It's about capacity and compassion. Doctors are becoming desensitized to suffering, not out of malice, but because their empathy reserves are depleted. A senior registrar we spoke to shared this sobering thought. It's not that I don't care. It's that I can't afford to care not if I want to make it through the shift. These are people who once swore an oath to do no harm, but they are being harmed by the very system they serve. They miss birthdays, weddings, funerals. They miss themselves, their creativity, their vitality, their sense of balance. And when they do finally burn out, they're often told to take a break, a luxury that many rosters simply don't allow. Let's call it what it is. This is not sustainable. This is not normal. This is not okay. If we demand heroism from our junior doctors, we must also offer them protection. Because beneath the scrubs and stethoscopes are people. People who cry in their cars. People who whisper apologies to their kids over Zoom. People who love this country but are quietly wondering if it loves them back. Part 4, When Overseas Beckons. It starts with a conversation. A message in a private group chat. An old classmate posting sunlit hospital selfies from Brisbane or Perth. A recruiter's email with promises of better pay, predictable hours, and relocation bonuses. And slowly, sometimes suddenly, it starts to seem inevitable. The exodus is not an exaggeration. In 2023 alone, the Medical Council of New Zealand recorded over 800 applications for certification verification, the paperwork needed to practice overseas. These aren't tourists. They're taxpayers' investments. They're graduates of Otago, of Auckland, of the University of Waikato's growing medical programs, and increasingly they are walking away. Why? The reasons are many, but they coalesce around one central idea. Self-preservation. Take Dr. Jason, a surgical house officer from Dunedin. After 2 years of 60-hour weeks, minimal mentoring, and 4 missed family events, he applied for a post in Queensland. 3 weeks later, he had an offer with a salary 30% higher, a relocation stipend, and guaranteed mental health leave. No debate, no fight, no guilt. It wasn't just the money, he says. It was the dignity. In Australia, hospitals are actively recruiting Kiwi doctors. Some even have dedicated HR teams that track New Zealand graduation cycles. They know when our students finish their final exams. They know when our junior doctors hit burnout. And they know exactly when to pounce. They offer relocation assistance for families. Housing support sometimes for an entire year. Guaranteed rotations in specialties of interest rather than the scattershot placements common here. And crucially, respect. Meanwhile, back home, our public hospitals continue to rely on goodwill, guilt, and the myth of the Kiwi battler, the doctor, who toughs it out, who puts patients first, who endures. But let's be clear, you cannot guilt someone into sacrificing their well-being indefinitely, not when they see another option. And when doctors leave, it's not just a personnel issue. It's a financial hemorrhage. Each junior doctor represents an estimated $250,000 in public investment by the time they complete their medical training. From subsidized university fees to clinical placements and internship structures, we pay for their skills. And then we give them away. Australia, the UK, Canada, they don't need to train more doctors. They just need to wait for ours to become too tired to stay. In some hospitals across New South Wales and Victoria, up to 30% of junior staff are now New Zealand trained. Some regional hospitals specifically target Māori and Pacifica graduates, hoping to diversify their workforce, a diversity built on our own unmet commitments at home. This isn't just a brain drain. It's a kindness drain, a courage drain, a future drain. One senior clinician in Tamaki Makaurau said bluntly, "We are becoming a finishing school for the Australian health system. The consequences are cumulative. Rural hospitals that can't maintain weekend coverage. Emergency departments staffed by short-term locums unfamiliar with the community. Surgical backlogs stretching into months, sometimes years. And for the doctors who leave, very few return. Not because they don't care. Not because they don't miss home. But because coming back means returning to the same dysfunction they once fled. In survey after survey, when asked what would convince them to return, the answers are strikingly consistent. Work-life balance, fair remuneration, a voice in decision-making, and a culture that doesn't treat burnout as a badge of honour. This isn't betrayal. It's clarity. The system isn't just losing people. It's giving them away because it refuses to change. And every time it happens, we lose more than a name on a roster. We lose mentorship for the next generation. We lose cultural competence in underrepresented communities. We lose the very people we need to fix the system. Part 5, a glimmer of change. Hope in the public health system is often rationed like medication. Too much and you risk disappointment. Too little and nothing heals. But despite the frustration, the departures, the heartbreak, there are signs. Small ones, uneven, incomplete, but real. Te Whatua New Zealand's newly unified health agency has promised to do things differently. It inherited a fragmented system, patchy across DHBs, burdened by bureaucracy and riddled with regional inequality. Now it's begun to centralise decision-making, reform workforce planning, and pilot mental health initiatives for frontline staff. Among the proposals, more dedicated mentorship time for junior doctors, not just shadowing, but structured protected learning blocks. Streamlined rosters to prevent excessive back-to-back shifts. Psychological support units embedded directly into hospitals, not outsourced to third-party providers. And yes, after years of stagnation, pay negotiations are finally on the table. In 2024, a revised multi-employer collective agreement, MECA, was put forward, aiming to improve base salaries and provide clearer protections for leave entitlements. It was a start, but as one doctor noted, we've had starts before. What we need is follow-through. Junior doctors have heard the speeches. They've read the press releases. But for many, the promises feel like déjà vu, another cycle of high-level concern followed by low-level implementation. As one third-year house officer said, "We don't need more wellness posters in the staff room. We need fewer 15-hour shifts and someone to talk to when we crash emotionally at 3 a.m. Still, some local changes show promise. In Hawke's Bay and Northland, small pilot programs trialled teaching protected Fridays half days where junior doctors could focus on learning, reflection, or debriefing. The early data was compelling. Reported burnout symptoms dropped by 22%. Clinical error rates decreased. Patient satisfaction improved. A similar scheme in Canterbury saw junior doctors paired with a dedicated senior mentor, someone they could call without fear, ask questions, and vent to without judgment. The result? Retention went up, confidence grew, and so did the sense of belonging. But these are still the exception, not the rule. They are fragile programs, often reliant on individual champions within DHBs or short-term funding windows. The doctors aren't asking for miracles. They're asking for consistency, for systems that don't collapse when one colleague calls in sick, for leave that is actually granted, for decision makers who ask, "What do you need and mean it?" Some DHBs have begun, including junior doctors on workforce committees. Others have introduced anonymous feedback loops directly into scheduling platforms so concerns about burnout or unsafe rosters can be flagged early. These steps matter, but they are a foundation, not a fix. Reform won't come from optimism alone. It will come from investment, from leadership, from listening, because behind the headlines and health board briefings are human beings brilliant, trained, and exhausted. They're not asking for special treatment. They're asking for a fair chance to thrive. One junior doctor told us, "We don't need hero worship. We need humane policies." And maybe that's where the real glimmer of change begins, in replacing applause with action. Part 6, Through the Eyes of a Nation. Let's step outside the hospital corridors for a moment and look at this crisis not through the eyes of a junior doctor, but through the eyes of the nation. What does it mean for all of us when the people trained to care are being systematically worn down? It means this. When your child breaks a leg on a Saturday night, there might be a 6-hour wait in ED, not because no one cares, but because there are simply too few staff to see them. It means your grandmother's hip replacement is delayed again as surgical lists are reprioritized due to workforce gaps. It means your GP quietly tells you they've had to close their clinic every second Friday because the only locum they relied on has left for Australia. It means that behind the curtain in the emergency department, the doctor stitching your partner's head wound has been awake for 20 hours. This isn't hypothetical. This is the daily reality across Aotearoa. From Auckland to Invercargill, from Wangaratta to Wairarapa, stories pour in from patients and clinicians alike. And as the strain worsens, something more subtle but no less damaging is happening. We are losing faith. Faith in the public health system that once made this country proud. Faith in the idea that anyone, regardless of income, background, or postcode, could get quality care when they needed it. Faith in the social contract that says, "We will look after each other." Instead, we're hearing whispers of despair. "Don't get sick on a weekend. Try to hold on until morning. We had to drive 3 hours to find someone who could see Dad." What used to be unthinkable delays in urgent care, underqualified staffing, entire departments closing overnight is now too common to be called a crisis. It's becoming the norm. But let's be very clear, this is not inevitable. It is the result of choices. Governments choose how much to allocate to health.
Health boards choose how to structure rosters.
Administrators choose whether doctors are supported or simply expected to endure. And when we talk about choice, we must also talk about values. What kind of country do we want to be? Aotearoa has long prided itself on egalitarianism, on fairness, on care for the collective. But right now, the burden of that ideal is falling squarely on the backs of our most idealistic young professionals. They entered medicine to serve, to heal, to give. Instead, they're being asked to sacrifice endlessly and often invisibly. And as they collapse under that weight, it's not just hospitals that suffer. It's the heart of the nation itself. Because when we lose doctors, we don't just lose staff. We lose hope. Hope that the system can cope. Hope that we'll be cared for when we need it. Hope that our best and brightest won't be driven away. A public health system is more than a service. It's a taonga, a precious thing that reflects who we are. Right now, that taonga is tarnished. Not beyond repair, but in desperate need of care. And care like health begins with attention. It begins with listening, with seeing what's really happening, and with the courage to say, this isn't good enough, we can do better. Because if we don't, then when your child cries, or your father collapses, or your partner clutches their chest, the help you need may already be gone. Closing the future they deserve. We began this episode with a question. Why is a career meant to save lives, draining the life out of our own? Now we end with another. What future do our junior doctors deserve? Because they don't just deserve better conditions. They deserve a system worthy of their sacrifice. They deserve a country that doesn't just rely on their resilience, but rewards it, protects it, and learns from it. New Zealand has done this before. In decades past, our health system was hailed as a global example of equitable care, accessible, public, proud. We trained brilliant doctors, and we kept them. We recognized that healthcare wasn't just a service, it was a statement about who we are as a people. We can be that country again, but not by hoping, not by waiting. And certainly not by asking burnt-out 27-year-olds to just hang in there a bit longer. It starts with telling the truth, with acknowledging that the system is broken not at the edges, but at the core. It starts with rejecting the myth that things are not that bad, that some fatigue is just part of the job. Because part of the job shouldn't mean panic attacks in toilets. It shouldn't mean missing births, weddings, or your own mental health. It shouldn't mean watching a patient die, not because you didn't care, but because the system gave you no time to act. The doctors we've spoken to aren't asking to be heroes. They're asking to be heard. To be human. To be seen not as cost units on a spreadsheet, but as people who trained for years not to get rich, but to help. And if we don't act, if we continue to undervalue, underpay, and overwork them, then yes, they will leave. But they won't be the ones who failed. We will be. We, the voters. We, the policymakers. We, the patients who said nothing until we had to wait 6 hours in an emergency room. So what now? We demand more. We demand funding that matches our public praise. We demand systems that don't just recruit, but retain. We demand leadership that listens. We demand a future where junior doctors don't just survive, but thrive. Because the truth is simple. A broken health system doesn't just break its workers. It breaks all of us. So next time you pass a hospital, pause, spare a thought for the people inside. They're not just saving lives. They're asking for help. And it's time we answered.